Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find it on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. The shot seen round the world. There's no doubt about the brutality and carnage in the pictures coming out of Tehran these days, but do all of the extreme close-ups from cell phone pictures and blogging eyewitnesses really tell us what's going on in Iran? Democracy now, democracy when? Looking for a wide shot on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here on a busy Monday morning, June 22nd, 2009. Besides all the angles on Iran, we've got soggy golfers at the U.S. Open. What the heck is a correspondence dinner in the age of citizen journalists? And a model for healthcare in Massachusetts coming up, along with everything you need to know this morning. And in the headlines, we'll start with the very latest from Iran. There's a new threat against Iranian election protesters from the country's most feared security force. The elite Revolutionary Guard now warns of major confrontation if opposition demonstrators take to the streets. We're also hearing a new admission from the government of the highly unusual results in certain districts. Iran's Guardian Council, the top election authority, says votes in some areas exceeded the number of voters living there, but the council says these irregularities didn't affect the final outcome. Asian markets closed up this morning. The S&P starts trading at 921. The Dow begins at 8539. The NASDAQ is at 1827. On Mondays, we always ask the question, what's going on? We go now to the Marcuses, as we usually do at the beginning of the week. Marcus Mabry of the New York Times and Jonathan Marcus of the BBC in London. So what story is going to drive things this week? To both of you, Jonathan Marcus first.
Undoubtedly, the unfolding events on the streets of Iran. I think that's clearly now the story. Everybody is looking to see what happens next. Is this going to fizzle? Is the regime going to be able to reestablish, at least for now, control? Or are the protests, demonstrations going to continue? And more importantly, are the fissures and the cracks in Iran's ruling elite going to become ever more pronounced?
Marcus Mabry of the New York Times, do you agree with that? And will the biggest headline be inside Iran or outside Iran in the reaction?
I absolutely agree, and it's going to be interesting to see. You know, I think, as we said last week, you can kill these protesters for now and these demonstrations for now, but if you do that, this regime is just going to drive it underground. The challenge to watch here from the U.S. is, what will the Obama administration's reaction be? I think, again, the president is going to reemphasize in an interview that we do not want the issue to become the United States, so he's going to keep his a lower profile. But I think the opponents of the administration will this week, in addition to criticizing Iran and the reaction to that, they will also be criticizing the president, because we'll see his health care and his financial derivatives regulation both coming up to hearings in the House.
And that's on the domestic front. Stay with us, Marcus. Is more on all of this coming up on the agenda in just a moment. And we, as always, have something for you to think about this morning and all day here on The Takeaway. There's the BBC, the New York Times, and us, The Takeaway. But news about Iran is also coming, as we mentioned, from Twitter, from Facebook, from other places that are new now, proliferating all over the digital space. Give us your source book. How do you assemble your front page? Everyone has a personal front page, and you can customize it more than ever in this age. Tell us your source book at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What's on your Rolodex at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Our government.
Healthcare.
Your government.
The economy.
Bailout.
Global financial recession.
Transportation.
Agenda.
The work that needs to be done.
What's going on? What's going on? What's going on?
Good morning, everyone. Continuing now with the agenda this Monday morning on The Takeaway, I'm John Hockenberry. Marcus Mabry, international business editor for The New York Times, staying with us. Also, BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus is with us from London. Jonathan and Marcus, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, you both said at the top of the hour that Iran is going to drive things this week. We began with the ambience of this very, very iconic photo coming out of Iran of a woman or a person. Neda is the name. Someone who was clearly gravely injured in Iran. In Tiananmen Square, we knew that that young man was standing in front of a tank in Tiananmen Square, and the reporting on it became iconic, and it was all very, very clear. Jonathan Marcus, stories like this, pictures like this, out of context, are certainly iconic, but do they mean anything, Jonathan?
Well, I think one obviously is cautious as a news provider in pointing out the problems with sourcing, identifying the exact circumstances of what happened and so on. But I think the power of the images are such, particularly spread over sort of networking sites and so on, that I think that in a sense that leaves all the kind of journalistic niceties behind. This is a very powerful image, and clearly one hopes it's not an image that is repeated in the days to come. But I think it will have a very powerful impact upon the perceptions of what is going on in Iran.
Again, if you've seen the images, woman gravely injured, not clear if she was shot by the security forces or took a stray bullet in a crowd. This bears directly on your job day to day, Jonathan Marcus, in the sense that your senior correspondent in Tehran has been kicked out. You basically have to respond to these pictures and make a decision sort of moment by moment whether this is part of the story or not.
Well, this is a huge problem that we're facing. I mean, if you like, this whole avalanche of citizen journalism, what we call it here, user-generated content, all of the Twitters, the pictures from mobile phones and so on that are flooding out of Iran, it presents very serious problems. And you're quite right, the BBC's well-established correspondent in Tehran, John Lyon, has been expelled by the authorities. They are particularly annoyed at the British, I think probably largely because of the BBC's Farsi television service, a relatively new BBC network, which clearly the Iranians do not like. They don't much like the British for historical reasons anyway. And so in the absence of permanent correspondents versed in what's going on in Iran and with the good contacts on the ground and so on, it's going to be much, much harder to get a barometer, to get a gauge on really the significance of the events on the ground there.
Well, Jonathan Marcus, there are the headlines inside Iran, and then, of course, there are the headlines as the international community reacts to what's going on in the headlines outside of Iran. The question today in the agenda is criticism like this going to stick to Barack Obama this week? Listen.
I'd like to see the president be stronger than he has been, although I appreciate the comments that he made yesterday. I think we ought to have America lead. When you look at the statements by President Sarkozy, Chancellor Merkel, and Prime Minister Brown have been much stronger. We should lead.
Marcus Mabry, does that charge stick to Barack Obama anytime this week?
It'll be interesting to see. It'll be one of the questions definitely to watch this week, John. You're absolutely right. So far, the criticism has not felt particularly salient. Again, you have Senator McCain there talking about how the president, he'd come out over the weekend and said this was violent and unjust reaction from the government. That's on the face of it. We all know that. That's clear. Whether one leads by talking or not, you know, Barack Obama has never been a big leader by talking. So I think it's unlikely he'll respond to that criticism this week. We'll see if it sticks. But more importantly is, what is the real U.S. response to it, whether that's overt or covert, as far as what one does with relation to this opposition that clearly, in this division among the clerics that rule this country.
At the very least, though, does this threaten this tentative policy of engagement with Iran that Barack Obama signaled he was for during the campaign?
You know, that's been exactly the issue from the beginning since the June 12th elections were challenged. Those who support the Obama administration in an open dialogue with Iran have been saying this is exactly why we need dialogue. Those who oppose it said this is exactly why Iran is not worthy of dialogue. I think the administration is going to have a harder and harder tightrope to walk this week. As you say, we are, you know, obviously supportive of the democratic aspirations of the Iranian people and of the opposition, and at the same time, try not to offend those who rule the country, who are right now the most important strategic interest of the United States is getting a handle, stopping the enrichment of nuclear materials in Iran, which continues apace, absolutely separate from this. And the one thing you probably would be able to join both Iranian sides on, as the president said this morning on television, is if you actually make the U.S. the issue here.
And that's, you know, what he's trying desperately to avoid in the rhetoric by dissociating himself with Mousavi, although claiming in general the principle of democracy is something that the United States supports.
That's exactly right. We're trying not to get involved in it as a voice in this struggle with Iran.
The Supreme Court this week may blow away or at least modify a 25-year or more legacy of American sort of voting freedom. Listen to this.
The right to vote is the crown jewel of American liberties, and we will not see its luster diminished. The legislation that I'm signing is the longest extension of the act since its enactment and demonstrates America's commitment to preserving this essential right.
Ronald Reagan signed a 25-year extension of the Voting Rights Act. Now the Supreme Court may take some of the luster off the original mission of the Voting Rights Act, but the argument may be, is it outdated? What could happen when the Supreme Court rules?
Well, the ruling is expected to come before the end of the term next week, and so it could be this week, it could be the very early part of next week. And the question is, do certain jurisdictions which fall under the Voting Rights Act, who have to at this point come to the federal government before they enact any changes in how they do any of the, conduct any of their elections. So whether it's moving a polling station from one area to another, whether it is putting a ballot in Spanish or in another language, any change at all that they implement, they must come to the Fed and say, this is what we're doing. The reason they must do that is because those jurisdictions have historically had a problem with disenfranchising certain voters. Most often it's African-American voters, given the history of the situation. You have new jurisdictions, particularly one in Texas, which says, you know, we didn't exist when the Voting Rights Act happened. This is a utility district where they vote for utility elections out
there. That's the issue in the actual case.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
And so the larger issue is, when does this end? Will these jurisdictions forever be underneath the thumb, as it were, there, as the opponents of this part of the Voting Rights Act would say, of the federal government? Or do they have some point, you know, are they freed from this purgatory? Especially now, some of them have argued that you have an African-American president, so to some extent, America must have made progress. The supporters of the Voting Rights Act and of this provision of the Voting Rights Act, they say that this is a crucial part of the act, that it is without this kind of supervision, you gut the act. It's going to be interesting to see how this conservative court decides this case. And the supporters of the Voting Rights Act say that it's going to have magnificent ramifications.
Will it be narrowly divided? Will it be a unanimous decision? Will the debate start up immediately on what to do about the Voting Rights Act if that case does come down this week? And as you say, it could be any time between now and the end of the term. Jonathan Marcus oversees Pakistan on the ground, on the battlefield, is gearing up for a final offensive. How is that likely to dominate events outside of Iran?
Well, of course, that's all been continuing in the wake of the dramatic events in Iran. I think opinion abroad is mixed. You know, I think there's a feeling that the Pakistan military, to some extent, has done better than many might have expected. But nonetheless, there are others who say, well, if this is what they're capable of, then why didn't they act much sooner? Why don't they act much more extensively? So I think really we're going to be watching very, very carefully to see what is the overall outcome of all of this. And of course, a huge problem for Pakistan, often forgotten, is that this internal fighting has displaced huge numbers of people. There is a huge internal refugee problem inside Pakistan because of this. And perhaps Pakistan hasn't really got all of the help that it might have needed from the outside world to try and grapple with this very, very serious problem of dislocation internally.
And I guess the question there is, at what point does Pakistan look like it's being held off, held at bay by Batullah Masood, the Taliban leader, and a bunch of ragtag militants there? That's really the question. We won't know that, but at least as far as this week is concerned, it looks like a final offensive is being geared up. But finally, Marcus Mabry, and I may have a question for you, Jonathan, on this. The Rihanna Chris Brown trial is going to begin. This is a huge subject. The question of dating, of celebrities, of role models. Where do you think this is going to go very quickly?
Well, you know, this is going to be, Rihanna will be testifying today in Los Angeles. this is a pretrial hearing to decide if there's going to be a trial or not of Chris Brown in his alleged beating of her
right.
When they were in a relationship. This has kind of shocked the popular cultural world. No one expected this from him.
And it evokes race. It evokes popular culture. It evokes celebrity. Do you know any Rihanna songs, Jonathan Marcus? Quickly. All right. As he laughs, Jonathan
Umbrella.
Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for the New York Times. That's your agenda.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
As I've been watching for about the last 30 seconds, 278 more tweets on Twitter coming from, that's right, Iran. We're following the latest from Iran. You may be listening to us. You may be watching CNN or reading the New York Times, looking at YouTube. How do you assemble your front page? What's your news diet?
My name is Ian, and I read Meaningful Distractions at WordPress.com, and then BBC, CNN, Al Jazeera, Facebook, and then Twitter. Pretty much all of this and more.
How are you keeping up? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And you got to know, there were people tweeting and YouTubing from the U.S. Open. Standing there in the mud with their BlackBerries, all of the U.S. Open correspondents and our friend and Takeaway contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen put on his mud boots and ventured out to the Bethpage Black Course yesterday. Ibrahim, thanks for coming in. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
The U.S. Open, it was a weather story as much as a sports story, wouldn't you agree?
Without a doubt. I think it was supposed to be done today, but now it's going to go on for another day.
So it's delayed by rain. The questions of quality of golf related to the weather are certainly things we want to talk about. But listen to the leader by one shot, par 70 in the third round, Ricky Barnes.
I don't think you come in and say, you know, I'm going to win this week. I wanted to compete this week. You know, I definitely thought that I could compete. You know, and I'll take it. I'll take a lead after, you know, 54 holes in any event, you know, let alone the U.S. Open.
He sounds like a walk-on there, Ricky Barnes. Does the crowd love this humble golfer?
I think, yeah, they're following Ricky a lot. The U.S. Open is part of the USGA's tournament, and it's a place where some of the players that are made the cut are not even going to get paid at the end of it. So It's a very, very egalitarian field.
And tell us about the golf. I mean, the question of Barnes and the people who were chasing Barnes throughout the tournament is one story, but then there's also Tiger and Phil Mickelson, who were well back but having a battle of their own.
Well, Mickelson is now chasing everyone. Mickelson has positioned himself in a space where he could take it if he has a really great day today. I think the other story is Duval. Duval's a guy that is kind of creeping in the back, and he's in the top group as well. But it's definitely Barnes. Barnes is basically tournament to lose at this point. Barnes and Glover's tournament to lose.
Does the condition of the course really become a factor here, where you're talking about radically different rain moment to moment, hole to hole? I mean, there's really no consistency here.
I think everyone was talking about the back nine being the most difficult, and that people were having the hardest time with that. They kept mentioning that it was slower, that the surface wasn't as forgiving, and so things aren't as landing as they normally would, and you don't get that bounce.
I've got to figure, even with the challenge and the sort of golf analysis of the implications of the rain here, that they're never going to come back to New York for this tournament. No way the U.S. Open is going to be in Bethpage, Long Island anymore.
It's funny. The crowds are extremely unruly. At one point, you had like the three green yelling to the two tees saying three green sucks and two green sucks. But the crowds that you're going to get in New York are going to be like no other place in the country. So I think the golfers kind of like it. They kind of like the unruly atmosphere. It's not a golf crowd. It's a sports crowd.
And so the weather is actually trumped by the unruly crowds. Didn't Tiger Woods at one point have to shush the people?
Completely. But Tiger, man, his golf is a game of focus and a game of self-control. for Tiger to have to do that, that means they must have really made a big mess.
All right. So what do you expect to happen today? The weather doesn't seem great. There could be a cloud burst in the middle of the tournament. You want a sort of prediction for
us? I would keep your eyes on. I mean, Barnes and Duval, I'll keep your eyes on Duval. I mean, I think that he's coming up, and I keep your eyes on Mickelson. He's got the crowd willing him into birdies right now because they love him. Everyone's like, where's Phil? Where's Phil? They love Phil right now as much as they love Tiger on that course, and I think they're going to will him into a great finish.
On a wet day, when it's sort of all or nothing here on the last day of the tournament, does the putter become more of a factor than the driver and the chip?
I mean, that's the challenge. Everyone's basically been like, can you get the green and then can you get in there? People aren't making birdie that easily. So it's going to be your putting. Tiger, for example, has been getting into the green, but his putting has been horrible. So you're right. The putting is critical today.
All right. Weather has always been a story at Wimbledon where it's always a little bit early to be outside eating strawberries in the UK. But the big story, the big cloud over Wimbledon is that Nadal's not going to be there. What do you make of that?
I think it makes the field a lot more interesting, and it clears the way for Andy Murray to become the champion of England.
But Federer is going to win, period.
Well, that's the thing.
What do you mean the thing?
Federer should win, but to me, I think Murray is the guy that everyone should be looking for. Murray has he'll have the force of being in his home country. He's beaten Federer and he's beaten Nadal before. He's the number three player in the world. I think he's going to take it.
All right. So what about the women's game, though?
I mean, it's the Williamses. It's Williamses versus the Williamses. 7 out of the last 9 have been won by one of the Williamses. And out of those 3, they've played each other 3 times. So I think you have a young crop of women that are chasing them. And, if, you know, they could break through this time. We'll see what happens.
You know, on the men's game, we should point out that he's Scottish, not British.
Indeed,
and so there will be a bit of a. Yeah,
he would be the first. How about this?
There'll be some people cheering for Federer there. Exactly. That's for sure. Well, we can find out all about your reaction to the U.S. Open and any other sort of sports issues that you want to raise on your blog, which is now on thetakeaway.org, right?
Correct, yes.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen writing about the finish of a wet U.S. Open and the start of a roofed-in Wimbledon at thetakeaway.org. Thanks, Ibrahim.
Thank you.
Let it be. Not a chance. Headlines with Femi O'Kay.
Thank you. Almost 28 minutes past the hour. The new American general in Afghanistan is planning to sharply reduce the use of airstrikes there. That news comes, according to our partners at the New York Times. It's part of an effort to reduce civilian deaths. President Obama is speaking out about North Korea. He told CBS News in a pre-taped interview that aired this morning that the U.S. is ready for whatever may happen in South Korea and North Korea.
We are prepared for any contingencies. I don't want to speculate on hypotheticals, but I do want to give assurances to the American people that the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted in terms of what might happen.
This news comes as an American Navy destroyer shadows a North Korean ship. The Pentagon says that the ship may be carrying banned materials. A Veterans Affairs hospital in Philadelphia botched a common surgical procedure 92 times over 6 years, according to reports in both the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer. Both newspapers report that patients were given incorrect radiation dosages during surgery to attack prostate cancer. The president of the Southern Russian Republic of Ingushetia is in critical condition after an assassination attempt earlier today. One bodyguard was killed in the attack and several others were wounded. And that's a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. Amidst all of the images coming out of Iran, perhaps you saw the video clips that were also playing all weekend long from the Friday night Washington radio and TV correspondents' dinner. There on the dais, the President of the United States, some bigwig journalists in the hall, journalists sitting, eating, listening to the president, talking among themselves. But there weren't any citizen journalists there, none of the tweeters or citizen journalists that are dominating the headlines. But there was a joke from the stage that actually referred to them.
At this very moment, the fate of Iran is strangely entwined with the sleep schedules of the geeks who maintain the servers at Twitter and YouTube.
Perhaps the first punchline in the history of the universe that ended with Twitter and YouTube. And the man who composed that joke, John Hodgman, writer, actor, comedian, you may know him from the Apple commercials, you may know him from Comedy Central, joins us from Brooklyn, New York. John, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
It seemed very interesting that in 2009, the idea of a radio and TV correspondents' dinner in one place, it seemed to me there were a lot of reporters and journalists who weren't invited. I'm wondering if that was your perception as you looked around the hall on Friday evening.
Well, I mean, I think the whole hall was connected with the world via Twitter as journalists sort of shamefacedly Twittered from their BlackBerries and iPhones quietly from the floor. But there wasn't a lot of that coming into the hall, I don't think. That's true.
I must say, in this time when the question of the whole profession of journalism is up in the air and, you know, with newspapers on the block are actually going out of business, it must have been a strange event to view both the Obama administration and the nation's capital. What are some of your impressions?
Well, look, I mean, you know, I have an enormous amount of respect for everyone in that room. There is a
why?
Well, there's an incredible role that professional news gathering plays in our lives, and by no means is social networking ever going to replace that.
Are you sure?
No, I'm quite certain, because what we're experiencing right now with Twitter is the effect of what Andrew Sullivan called journalistic pointillism. You know, you have now thousands, if not many, many more individual voices that are coming over from Iran specifically via Twitter or via YouTube. And it's incredibly important. But each individual voice is confused, perhaps, or not always reliable, not always a perfect picture of what's going on.
Well, it's out of context anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. But you get from the entire cloud of information that's coming over a larger, broader, and fascinating picture.
You know, John,
we've never seen before, because it's individuals speaking to individuals.
Sure. Well, John, you know, I'm a big admirer of your comedic work, although listening to you talk right now, I'm thinking there aren't a lot more jokes that involve Twitter and YouTube in the future.
Not in the morning.
No, I see. I see. So did the president, what did the president refer to you as when he shook your hand?
Did he refer to me?
Yeah, he called you something, didn't he?
I don't know what he was saying behind my back, but we were speaking generally about sort of the difference between jocks and nerds on stage.
Oh, really? Is that right?
Yeah.
Didn't he call you the guy on TV?
Oh, he may well have, yes. But that's news to me. So you're breaking news to me.
Yeah, there we go. I'll just have to tweet.
I did not read that on the Twitter feed.
I don't have to tweet it. I just have a radio program. It's right, terribly inefficient.
The idea, I mean, you know, jockism and nerdism as a philosophy, it's something that begins in high school when people first encounter sports and or math, and they kind of choose a path. And jockism being this idea of conformity, happiness with conformity and authority, and what you can see, touch, and feel around you. And nerdism is being a group that defines its tribes by passions. And those passions can be technology, or those passions can be ideas that are spread by technology.
You're really scaring me now, John. I'll just hang in here. Let's talk a little bit about how nervous you must have been following Barack Obama. Did your nervousness express itself in any alarming way?
Well, no. I mean, it only made sense that I follow Barack Obama. He couldn't follow me. I'm the most dynamic public speaker of our generation.
Yes, right. Well, thanks for doing the president a favor there. But were you
off
nervous?
The hook, didn't I? Well, of course, I was nervous. It's the first time that I've spoken to that sort of group of people, and I mean specifically that group of people, but also a Washington, D.C. crowd. But most important, it's the first time I've ever been in the same room as any president of the United States, and that's very, very strange when you see someone you know so very well on television right up close. So.
How was it hanging with the Secret Service? Did they, you know, observe your behaviors and think you were
comfortable? I have a habit of pacing around sort of when I'm rehearsing and thinking things through. I'm actually sort of pacing around right now. And as I was doing that to the side of the stage, getting ready for my speech, a guy took me aside and said, we would prefer that you not do that.
Get out of here. The Secret Service?
So much, yeah.
How did they say that?
The gentleman came over and said, excuse me, we would really like it if you didn't move around so much.
And he had one of those Secret Service earpieces in and everything?
Yes, exactly.
Did you actually stop, or are you capable of stopping?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. When the Secret Service asks you to stop moving, I think it's better that you stop moving. Well, I come from the nerdish end of the spectrum. I have no wish to be tackled by anybody.
Right. John, a lot of people know you as one of the stars of the Mac PC commercials, and you play the PC character in those commercials. I have to ask before we go. I mean, it's totally
obvious. I anticipate the question.
It's totally obvious to me that you're a Mac user.
That is true, and I have been since 1984.
And we aren't making any headlines here. You've disclosed that before?
It is an open secret for all to know. There's plenty of pictures of me on the internet using an iPhone.
A couple of mole man names before we go.
Oh boy, you catch me up short, sir.
Man,
the mole man. You mean the race of intelligent creatures who live beneath the earth and
influence
the writing
of
our Declaration of Independence.
There we go.
Well, there is of course Genuine Hissfurther, who was Thomas Jefferson's chief collaborator in the Declaration of Independence.
Intelligent creatures who live below the earth and who wrote the Declaration of Independence. That's not all from John Hodgman. John Hodgman, thank you so much. Congratulations again on your performance with the president in front of the correspondents on Friday. John Hodgman, writer, actor, comedian, was the entertainment at the Washington Radio and TV Correspondents Dinner. Femi OK has the headlines now.
At almost 21 minutes to the top of the hour, the Iranian government is acknowledging that the number of votes cast in the country's contested presidential election exceeded the actual number of voters. But the country's top legislative body, the Guardian Council, says it's not clear if those votes would decisively change the election results. It's about 3 million votes altogether. Back in the US, a Rose Garden ceremony at the White House this afternoon could usher in a new era of anti-smoking regulation. President Obama will sign an anti-smoking bill that gives the FDA new regulatory powers over tobacco companies.
Congressman Waxman will probably explode at that ceremony.
And
he'll be so happy.
Oh, okay, because he's so happy. Okay, not because he's been smoking.
No.
Pop star and singer Rihanna is expected to give testimony in the trial of her former boyfriend and rap star Chris Brown today. He's charged with assault. Rihanna was allegedly beaten by Brown in his car after a party before the Grammys in February, and Brown has pleaded not guilty. Kodak is retiring its most senior film, the iconic Kodachrome.
Get out of here, really?
Yeah, absolutely. It's due to declining demand because of this digital age. Kodachrome was introduced back in 1935 and became the world's first commercially successful color film. And now it just makes up a tiny fraction of Kodak's film sales.
Uh-oh.
And that's your news.
That is sad. That's emotional. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, continuing now with John Hodgman, of course, who starred as the entertainment at the Washington Correspondents' Dinner on Friday with Barack Obama. But moving away from that, John.
Yeah, co-starred.
Co-starred, right, yeah.
Yeah,
you can't upstage the president at something like that, right?
No. We were obviously equals when it came to entertaining that night.
And, you know, your colleague, Stephen Colbert, really deliberately blurred the line between entertainer and newsmaker when he gave his very controversial speech in front of George W. Bush. Did you have any thoughts about standing on the shoulders of giants as you were up there?
Well, you know, as a member of the Daily Show and Colbert Report family, obviously, I felt very keenly the very high bar that Stephen had set, and it became clear that that was a destructive path to think on. There was no way to try to match it. You just had to do your own thing.
So let's look ahead. I talked in a moment ago about this act that you have where you deliver names of mole men. Explain to me. I mean, this is so down in the weeds. I mean, help me out here.
Well, you know, as I say, geekism is defined by...
No, you've already defined them.
Passions.
Right, that's fine.
And so, my books, the areas of my expertise and more information than you required are essentially books of fake trivia and fake history of what happened in the United States, but they're really just efforts in which I can express my most esoteric passions. And so, for example, I created this idea of this race of this hyper-intelligent but obviously very disgusting metahumans who live beneath the earth and influence world affairs. And so I decided, for no particular reason, to list 700 of their names.
I see. And the Trilateral Commission.
No one would tell me no.
The Trilateral Commission just doesn't, you know, that doesn't ring your chimes.
I've flown under their radar. They haven't tried to stop me yet.
I see.
As I reveal the obvious truth about the world around us.
So you create your own conspiracy of sort of, I imagine, fairly pasty-looking individuals who live underground and have names and have actually controlled all of world history.
Large eyes, fangs, acidic saliva. Obviously, they wear powdered wigs. But they're not they do not aim to control. They aim to help. It's really the hobos who are trying to control world affairs.
Hobos?
It's a whole different story.
Now, do you actually mean the people that ride the trains?
From the Great Depression, yes, exactly so.
So they're actually a conspiracy in your view?
They attempted to take over the United States government back in 1929, but that's a long story that didn't actually happen.
We should note that is a long story that didn't actually happen.
Right.
Now, what do audiences think about this invented conspiracy kind of idea? I would think they would find it attractive in some way.
Well, you know, obviously it's designed to reflect people's fears and imaginations of what's actually going on in the real world. I mean, conspiracy theories are seductive because they make sense of a world that is complex and kind of impersonal. It is nice to imagine that lots of people are actually plotting against you and your life.
In the last couple of seconds, literally, how do the mole men stack up to that other conspiracy of people who sit in dark rooms in front of microphones and control the world?
Well, the mole men are usually shorter in stature due to their being hunched over, so they have to stack up probably 5 to 1 to the average conspiracy.
And they have high-pitched, weird voices that wouldn't sound very good on the air. Right, John?
They're not usually radio professionals, no.
Thank you, John Hodgman.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. The news about Iran is reverberating around the world in Twitter, Facebook, other places. How do you assemble your front page? How are you keeping up with the latest?
Dave Foley calling from Boston, Massachusetts, and my news starts with public radio, of course, in the morning. And then when I want to follow up after that, I usually go on the internet and look at BBC and then also local news from the country wherever the news is happening.
877-8-MY-TAKE or email us your preferences at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And Femi Okay has the headlines.
It's almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, all. In Iran, there's a new threat against opposition protesters from the country's most feared security force. The elite Revolutionary Guard now warns of major confrontation if opposition demonstrators take to the streets. Now, according to Iran's government, at least 17 have died in clashes between protesters and Iranian security forces. We're also hearing this morning a new admission from the government of some highly unusual election results in many districts. Iran's Guardian Council, the top election authority, says that votes in some areas exceeded the number of actual voters living there. But the council says irregularities didn't affect the final outcome. Back in the United States this afternoon, President Obama signs groundbreaking new tobacco legislation into law. The Food and Drug Administration will now have power over tobacco products. The FDA will be able to reduce nicotine in products, ban candy flavouring, and block labels like light or low tar. In sports, there's some amazing news about the US professional soccer team. The team has made it into the semifinals of a major soccer tournament. The FIFA Confederations Cup is an international tournament that takes place every 4 years and considered to be a dress rehearsal before the big soccer World Cup. Now, to be honest, the US team were playing badly, really, really badly. But to make it into the semi-finals, they needed to win their next game by at least 3 goals, and Italy had to lose by 3 goals as well. So they pretty much needed a miracle. Guess what happened? That was one of the 3 goals that the U.S. scored, beating Egypt 3-0.
What is this cute little American's attitude? What is this? Nice little American.
No. Seriously, I thought it was amusing. Ibrahim thought it was amusing. But this is actually soccer history. It was a major upset. The U.S. beat Egypt 3-0. The Italians lost. And so the U.S. are now in the semifinals of the Confederations Cup. They play Spain on Wednesday.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Health industry groups are expected to deliver...
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
...to take over the healthcare system, either directly or indirectly, for the government to control it.
A lot of my friends, where they get their healthcare from is the emergency room. They're in the emergency room every week. They break a nail in the emergency room.
How are you going to avoid not having the ability to cost shift as you shrink that portion of privately funded health insurance?
Continuing our discussion now of healthcare reform as Washington attempts to grapple with a very, very complex issue in the early days of the Obama administration. Last week, we talked about how doctors imagine the changes in healthcare that are afoot. Today, we're going to talk about at least one model that may be looked at very seriously in Washington as a plan for changing the way people are covered in healthcare. It's called the Massachusetts Model for Universal Care. Can it be implemented on a national scale? Joining us to fully grasp how this model might be scaled up to a national level is Trudy Lieberman. She directs the Health and Medicine Reporting Program at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. She's also a longtime contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review and has been following the so-called Massachusetts model closely since 2006 when the sweeping reform was enacted. Trudy, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Now, this plan came in as a bipartisan plan under then-Governor Mitt Romney, if I'm not mistaken.
There were many, many supporters of the Massachusetts plan, not only the governor, the state legislator, the medical establishment in Massachusetts, and many of the advocacy groups.
2006, it was enacted. 2009, what's the update? Has it worked?
It's rather mixed. One can say that certainly more people have health insurance now than they had before. Some 400,000 people are now covered. They have insurance through public programs like Medicare, or they've been asked to buy insurance in the private market.
And how did the state accomplish this? Did it just wave a magic wand and say everyone's insured now, or did it actually have to enact new programs and come up with new sources of financing?
What they did is enact what's called an individual mandate, and the mandate is a requirement that just about everybody in the state must carry insurance. That means that if you have it from your employer, that's fine. If you don't have it from your employer or Medicare or Medicaid, then you have to go into the individual market and buy it. And so what people have done is, under threat of a tax penalty, a lot of them have bought policies.
So the model here is what they do in driver's licenses. I mean, you can get a license, but you can't register your car unless you can show proof of insurance. And the state, of course, is in control of car registrations. Is that working here to really bring everybody under the umbrella? Tax penalties might not work for everybody.
Well, it's a little bit different. In auto insurance, people are required to buy insurance generally to protect the other guy. It's liability insurance that's required. In the case of health insurance, it's really different because you're buying insurance to protect yourself and your family. And so what happens is that people either have to buy the policies, which might be quite expensive for them, or they have to take a tax penalty. I should add that there are subsidies for people who have incomes less than 300% of poverty. That's about $66,000 for a family of four and $32,000 for an individual. So those people get some help in terms of subsidies.
So 97% of the people in Massachusetts are now covered. That's a number certainly to be admired by the federal government. But how much has it cost the state? And is Governor Deval Patrick cleaning up something of a mess from the enactment of this 2006 legislation?
Well, there were serious problems with the law from the get-go. They really did not have any cost containment, cost controls built into the law. In fact, as one person told me, it wasn't even part of the conversation. The conversation in Massachusetts in early 2006 was just, let's get more people covered. And I should add that Massachusetts originally had a lot of people who were covered. It didn't have such high rates of uninsurance as many other states have. So essentially, they brought people into this mess that the rest of us in the country are in, and that's that costs continue to rise, and there doesn't seem to be any politically palatable way to curb them.
Does the Massachusetts model work in states like Mississippi or Arkansas or Nevada and Florida, where the demographics are so radically different?
I think there's a big question about that. As I've been doing my series for CJR.org on how the Massachusetts plan has worked and what lessons we can learn from it, I ask that question to many people up there. Does the plan travel well? And almost everybody I talked to up there was really skeptical about whether the Massachusetts plan can be translated to Mississippi or Texas, for example, because the rates of uninsurance are much higher in those states. And also in Massachusetts, the employers have provided coverage to workers more than they have in other states.
You know, one of the things that's frustrating to me is that the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, last week came out with this number, $1 point something trillion over 10 years is what this is going to cost. GOP and other lawmakers over the weekend said, that's a deal breaker. We can't do this if it's that expensive. I'm wondering, as an observer of all of this, we've done a lot of things in the United States that cost that much. I mean, the Iraq War is something that's going to probably cost $1 trillion in the end. Over 10 years, is $1 trillion truly an unreasonable deal breaker, whatever model we use for health care reform?
Well, I think it depends on what side of the fence you're on, because what has to happen is that if we mandate insurance for everybody in the United States, 85% of the uninsured can't afford to buy insurance, so they would be buying it now. The problem is that we need the money to pay for subsidies. Well, that's fine, and that's going to cost $1.6 trillion over 10 years. But unless there's a way to control the escalating costs of medical care, those costs are going to continue to rise.
Is there any advantage in politically the way Massachusetts did it? It did the mandate first and is sort of worrying about the head-scratching mathematics and cost problems later?
I think that's also debatable. I think, as somebody told me early on, that they've brought people into the same mess that the rest of us are in. And until that changes, they're going to have trouble paying for those subsidies.
Yes, indeed. One of the problems involved in implementing one of the health care models that Washington will be looking at, the Massachusetts model for health care reform. Trudy Lieberman, speaking with us, directs the Health and Medicine Reporting Program at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. Her series in CJR.org. You can find it there. Thanks so much, Trudy. We are linked to it from our website. All this morning, we've been following the latest from Iran, but how do you keep up? You may listen to a variety of sources. We want to know what they are. 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
In the absence of permanent correspondents versed in what's going on in Iran and with the good contacts on the ground and so on, it's going to be much, much harder to get a barometer, get a gauge on really the significance of the events on the ground there.
Jonathan Marcus from our partner, the BBC. You can re-listen to all of our Iranian coverage. You get our podcast to go. Subscribe at thetakeaway.org and keep up to date on the soggy U.S. Open with blogs from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. You can find it all at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Now, why would this joke be funny?
The fate of Iran is strangely entwined with the sleep schedules of the geeks who maintain the servers at Twitter and YouTube.
Nervous laughter from some well-fed Washington correspondents, while citizen correspondents from inside Iran signal a national emergency. Iran's digital calls to the global 911 line, crying fire in a crowded media theater on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. Monday, June 22nd. I'm John Hockenberry, and we are staying with the fast-moving story in Iran. Multiple voices and all the angles this hour. Citizen journalists and journalists with some context comparing now with the Islamic Revolution 30 years ago. Plus, Cher and Kanye West use it to sound like singing robots. Now The Takeaway will, too. You'll meet some sound artists who use the program Auto-Tune to remix voices in the news and comment on the media. The results are intriguing. You'll hear what happens when they put me in their digital blender, we'll call it. All this and plenty more, but we got the latest headlines. And in the headlines, fresh reports of new threats of violence and suspects voting results pouring out of Iran. Excuse me, the country's powerful Revolutionary Guard is out today with strong words threatening a major clash if opposition protesters hit the streets. The Guard is the country's most feared security force. Also, a new admission from the government of some highly unusual results in certain districts. Iran's Guardian Council, the top election authority, says votes in some areas exceeded the number of actual voters living there, commenting on the election last week. But the council claims these irregularities didn't affect the final outcome. Femi, okay, what else is up there?
Good morning, all. America's new top commander in Afghanistan is tightening up policy on the use of bombs there. Our partner, The New York Times, reports that General Stanley McChrystal will sharply restrict American airstrikes in Afghanistan, and the goal is to reduce civilian deaths. Back in the United States this afternoon, President Obama signed sweeping tobacco legislation into law. It will give the Food and Drug Administration new power to regulate tobacco products. In sports, Wimbledon kicks off today. The two-week tennis tournament has a new feature this year. A retractable roof over the main court means that play can go on even if it rains. I should say even when it rains. There's no roof over the course for golf's US Open, so it's been a long haul. Heavy rain dragged play into today on New York's Long Island.
And Rafael Nadal won't be at Wimbledon.
He won't. That's
a cloud.
Tendinitis.
That's a gloomy cloud, yes, over Wimbledon. Asian markets closed up this morning. The S&P starts trading at 921. The Dow begins at 8539. The NASDAQ is at 1827. And futures trading suggests a negative opening on Wall Street in a little less than a half an hour. We want to hear from you. Whatever your news source, everybody's digital front page is different in this news environment. We want to check in with you about your news diet. How are you keeping up with the latest? Tell us at 778 My Take, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You know, everyone is an editor in this era.
Okay.
Everyone edits their own news, assembles their own newscast from all of these various sources.
Yeah, and that's what an old-fashioned news editor would do, is to get all the news sources together. Now we can actually do it ourselves by sitting in front of our laptop.
You're an old-fashioned news editor?
Yeah.
8778 My Take, or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. You know, it's a problem in election reporting when the number of votes cast exceeds the number of actual voters in any given district. We begin in Iran, and that's exactly what authorities are saying today. They are acknowledging that the number of votes cast in 50 cities, perhaps, exceeded the actual number of voters. It's a direct challenge to the country's supreme leader, and that's what the Guardian Council is saying. Ayatollah Khamenei asserted last week that the ballot was fair. Joining us is someone with fresh memories of the 1979 Iranian Revolution, which may or may not be a model for what is taking place today. Bakr Moin is the former head of the BBC's Persian Language Service. He grew up in Iran and is the author of the authoritative book on Ayatollah Khomeini, who, of course, is the architect and spiritual leader of the 1979 Revolution, Khomeini, Life of the Ayatollah. Bakr Moin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
First of all, let me just ask you right off the top. You're watching these pictures and watching the people in the streets. How reminiscent of 1978 and 1979 is this for you? And what parallels should we not be drawing here, if any?
Well, the demonstrations and the reaction of the security services very much reminiscent of what was happening in 1979. This is a very interesting parallel. However, there are a number of differences. At that time, we had a government in charge that was exhausted, a Shah in power who had cancer without anybody knowing about it, and he was a lone man, in a sense, who used to make all decisions himself. And because of his cancer, he was paralyzed. He was waiting for the American and the British ambassador to see him and give him some ideas and how the world is reacting to what is happening inside the country. There is also one other parallel, is that even at that time, people used to go to their rooftops and they were shouting, Allahu Akbar, God is great, which was very unusual until then in Iran. And I think the present lot are learning from that. I think the third area that is very similar is the feel-bad factor, the unhappiness with the policies carried out by the state. I mean, the young people who are going into the street today want more freedom, social freedom, better life. The election for some of them really is an excuse to express their pent-up frustrations. But there are areas the parallel is not there, and I can go into them if you want me to.
Well, let's talk about that in a moment, but that's an interesting set of parallels for us to evaluate what happened in 1978 and 79 and what's unfolding right now. Just out of Iran is Robert Dreyfus, who's been reporting in Iran, covering the election for The Nation, where he's a contributing editor. He also blogs for Tehran Bureau. You're out of the country like most, if not all, foreign journalists. Robert Dreyfus, how slowly is this unfolding versus what we're seeing here in the United States, where it looks as though every day things are exploding?
Well, you know, going back to 1979, the revolution then took really more than a year to build. The first signs of it were at the end of 1977, and it gradually built wave upon wave until it crested around the end of 78, the beginning of 79. It's very possible that this current confrontation between an increasingly isolated regime in which the so-called leader or Rahbar, Ayatollah Khamenei, is increasingly isolated and perhaps even to some degree captive of or at least codependent with President Ahmadinejad, arrayed against not only the entire class of, you know, students and other protesters and workers and economic elite and so on, but even the clergy has begun to move away from this narrowly based regime. So there's no telling. This is a very unpredictable situation that will probably take months to play out. I can't resist pointing out that one more parallel with 30 years ago is that the regime then of the Shah blamed the BBC for all of its troubles.
Interesting.
And once again, in 2009, the current regime is blaming the BBC for inflaming the demonstrations. In both cases, obviously, wildly exaggerating the role of a radio network.
On the other hand, Robert, it's great to pass the great Satan mantle onto the BBC here in the United States from my personal perspective, although that's a cheap shot and we'll move on. Bakr Moeen and Robert Dreyfus, let's talk about this for a moment. The iconic images of the Islamic Revolution in the beginning were these enormous crowds in Tehran of people clad in black. Then it became the face of the Ayatollah himself, who, even without much retouching on the cover of Time magazine, looked pretty sinister to American eyes. And then finally, the iconic images of Iran became the hostage crisis. This time around, it's really these images of individual people being brutalized on the streets of Tehran. Bakr, what do you make of this contrast?
Well, the contrast is there. You can't hide it. But the one major difference is that during that revolution, you had three means of communication. books of Ayatollah Khomeini published like cassettes sent to Iran, cassettes of his voices distributed, and his statement being copied by various people and distributed at night. Now, you've got Twitter, you've got Facebook, you've got internet, you've got satellite television from all over. Anything happens, and half an hour later is either on YouTube or somewhere else. This is really a new vibration that didn't exist at all in Iran. And I think it's the new generation that is coming forward with their English placards. Before, you never saw in Iran that sort of thing. Occasionally, possibly one. Now, in every city that you see people are demonstrating, they've got these English placards because they want not only to show to themselves that they are different class, but also they want the world to know about them and what is happening to them. So I agree with Robert that it's really picking up. But I still believe that it's a movement to correct the wrongs. It's not a revolution on the same scale.
Although the Death to America placards were always in English in my memory of covering Iran in those days. Robert Dreyfus, and that's not to dispute your point, Bakr, I think it's absolutely clear what you're saying. Robert, one contrast, it seems to me, and comment on anything in the question that I asked earlier, but just to refine it, there, unlike 1978 and 79, where there was a face of the Iran, there's not a face of the Iranian government. There's no Shah face of the authority in Iran right now. It's a kind of diffuse tear gas image.
Well, yes and no. I mean, certainly in the West, the face of Iran is Ahmadinejad. He's been demonized and is, you know, now even more radioactive, which makes it much more difficult for Iran to carry out any kind of opening to the West or to respond to President Obama's overtures. And inside Iran, the face is really the leader. It's Khamenei, the Ayatollah, who runs the show. And people, you know, are polarized increasingly about both of these figures inside Iran. I think it's a real crisis of legitimacy for this regime, and it's one that they're going to find it very difficult to extricate themselves. I mean, in despite of what, you know, Bakr was saying, which I agree with about all these technologies and everything, this is a regime which, unlike the Shah's, is ruthless and fanatical and is willing to use sheer force to crush any kind of rebellion or revolt or even mild opposition against it. So,
well, although there may be some dispute over who's ruthless and brutal, and the Pahlavis had much to answer for.
Oh, not at all. I don't agree at all. I think that the number of people that were killed under the Shah's regime is minuscule compared to the number of people that have been butchered by these guys. And the Shah, as Bakr said earlier, did not. I mean, the army, some of them came to him in the last days and said, let us fire on these protesters, and he refused. These guys will not refuse if it comes to that. They will gun down hundreds in the streets.
All right, Bakr, before we go, take us through some of the history back in 78, 79. There was the Shah, then he left, then there was the Bazargan regime, and eventually there was an Islamic-created Bakhtiar regime, and then Ayatollah Khomeini came in and reset the deck. What are we likely to see as things progress here, even if it takes a year?
Well, the Shah left Bakhtiar behind as his last prime minister, and it was followed by the arrival of Ayatollah Khomeini from exile, and Bazargan took over. The difference this time is really, under the Shah, the regime was united. And the division was between the regime and the opposition. At the moment, what we have got is a disunited leadership in Iran. There is not one-man show, although Ayatollah Khamenei took all the responsibilities for Ahmadinejad has done or doing for himself. But nevertheless, the regime is not really united as it was before, and also there is no center of hate.
Bakr Moin, former head of the BBC's Persian Language Service. Stay with us. Robert Dreyfus, thanks so much for being with us. Just back from a reporting trip to Iran, Robert Dreyfus is contributing editor for The Nation. Thanks again, Robert.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Continuing now our coverage of the events unfolding in Iran, and the news from that country is coming from many places, on the streets of Tehran, but also some unusual sources. We're checking in with you and trying to get a sense of your source book, your news diet. How are you keeping up with the latest in Iran? Of course, you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You're listening to The Takeaway here, and you might be reading The New York Times, you might watch the BBC, you might look at Twitter. They're our partners, or perhaps you have a favorite radio show that you listen to, say, in Farsi.
Global Trends. روند جهانی. با عرض سلام به هموطنان عزیزم در لس آنجلس.
Certainly, listeners to Siamak Kalor, radio host for a technology show at KIRN Radio, an AM radio station in Los Angeles, and on the web that broadcasts exclusively in Farsi 24 hours a day, are interested in the latest news from Iran. Siamak joins us now from Los Angeles. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
And the latest news that I have this morning is that the council observing the elections in Iran has essentially challenged Ayatollah Khamenei by saying that they actually do have evidence that maybe there were more votes cast than are actually registered in the nation. Is that the headline you're getting this morning?
That was the headline I got, actually, in different sources of the news. It remains to be seen what's going to happen today.
All right. Siamak Kalor has lived in the U.S. for over 30 years, settled in Los Angeles, radio host focused on technology, and you can still be focused on technology and cover Iran this week, right, Siamak?
Well, we were focused in technology, and we covered Obama's election, too, presidency of the United States. So we are very interested in the current affair of the world, and especially right now in Iran.
Also with us is Bakr Moin, former head of the BBC's Persian Language Service, who also grew up in Iran, the author of the book Khomeini, Life of the Ayatollah. Bakr, thanks for staying with us. And how important are expatriate communities like the ones in Los Angeles and other places around the world in following this and trying to influence events?
They've been very important, really, to introducing new technology to the Iranians, number one. Number two, quite a lot of them participated in the elections across the globe. And also, when they were disappointed with the result, they really coordinated a great deal with people inside the country. Also, we have to understand that the Iranian community really is very open to the West, and the young Iranians would like to move forward. Education is very important for them. Traveling is very important. And having relatives abroad gives them an opportunity to come out and see the world. So they have a lot of input inside the country. One other factor is, I think, the democratization process that is going on in Iran among the civil movement may also help the Iranians abroad, because they have failed really to unite over a democratic project so far. This may be the beginning of a new change as well.
Siamak Kalor, do you think that your ratings have been affected by the events in Iran?
Absolutely. Our listeners, you know, we opened up our lines 5 days ago, and we canceled most of our regular programmings. We just let the people of Southern California and from Iran, from all over the world, Iranians, to just send their sentiments, then their opinion. We let them express what they think. So if I tell you my personal opinion, it's not really the truth of what's happening. So people of Iran have different opinions there. And here I see that we have fractions of people with their own opinions about the situation. Some people think this situation will continue. Some people, especially last night, I got a bunch of Twitter posts that they think Rafsanjani lost and Khamenei won. That was one of the things, and we should be careful. But altogether, the sentiment is the Green Party and hoping and supporting for the green movement in Iran, and I think the majority of people here in Los Angeles are supporting that, and they think it's not about the election anymore.
All right, Siamak, we got an email from one of our listeners, David, who says, sources on Iran that have been invaluable for me in the past week have been The Atlantic magazine's blogger Andrew Sullivan, Juan Cole's Informed Comment blog. They're not the traditional newspapers that most people use, David writes. What about Iranian Americans in L.A.? How are they keeping up with the latest news? What would you say?
We have our own hashtag in Twitter, and we have Facebook blogs, many, many blogs that this uprising has been blogged, tweeted, and Facebook since the beginning. But we can only hope that this popular uprising will sort of dispel the current format of the regime, not the regime itself, and perhaps even render the power of the clergy to a diminished role. But I think it didn't happen, and they are stopping it.
Let's, on the see what happens point, Rafsanjani was referred to a moment ago by Siamak Kalor. It's believed, according to some reports, that Rafsanjani, former president of Iran, has put in with Mousavi, the opposition. First of all, do you think that's true? And secondly, is it significant?
I'm
getting an answer from Bakar Muin.
Okay.
I think Mr. Rafsanjani's children, daughter Faiza and son Mehdi, did support Mr. Mousavi, and it's widely believed that he did support. I think he has taken a backseat, no doubt, to arrest his children and then release them. In a sense, not good for him. And I think Ayatollah Khamenei openly said that he has got differences with Mr. Rafsanjani, while he hasn't got with Mr. Ahmadinejad. Nevertheless, I think Rafsanjani's credibility has gone up because of his association with the opposition at the moment. And I think the game is not over. Still, within the system, there'll be much more pressure for openness, for more freedom, for the constitution to be applied as it is, before we reach a position that everything should be changed. There is no proper universal leadership as such as yet for the opposition to be able to push forward
really
from outside the regime.
Siamak Kalor, do you think that's true?
The assembly of experts, which is the most powerful group in Iran, is headed by Mr. Rafsanjani. They have 86 members. With 86 members, they can dismiss and replace Khamenei. They just released an official letter signed by its deputy director, Mohammad Yazdi, confirming that their full support for Khamenei. Apparently, Mr. Rafsanjani's effort to sway its 86 members to vote against Khamenei did not succeed, and he could not get the backing of the majority to stop Khamenei.
Well, the procedural news there, one of the headlines on KIRN Radio, Siamak Kalor, radio host for KIRN, broadcasting to the 500,000 Iranian-Americans in the Los Angeles area, and also to takeaway listeners. Also, I want to thank Bakar Muin. Bakar Muin, former head of the BBC's Persian Language Service. Thanks to you both. How do you keep up with news from Iran and everywhere else? We want to check in with you about your news diet. There are challenges and also opportunities today in assembling a set of sources to compose your own front page of the news of the day. Tell us what you do at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. We begin this segment with headlines from our own Femi Okay.
Thank you very much. The time is 28 minutes to the top of the hour. Just getting some news in from the Associated Press. Iranian police attacked hundreds of protesters with tear gas fired in the air to disperse a rally in Tehran. Now, this news comes after Iran's Revolutionary Guard said that demonstrators should prepare for a revolutionary confrontation if they take to the streets again.
Meanwhile, the country's highest electoral authority, the Guardian Council, is acknowledging that voting irregularities happened in 50 of the electoral districts, but the council insists that those votes didn't affect the outcome. Apple says that CEO Steve Jobs is on track to return to work at the end of June. The company refused to comment on a Wall Street Journal report this weekend that he received a liver transplant about 2 months ago. Pop singer Rihanna is expected to give testimony in the trial of her former boyfriend and rap star Chris Brown today. He's charged with assault. Rihanna was allegedly beaten by Brown in his car after a party before the Grammys in February, and Brown has pleaded not guilty. Let's look at some of the stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. Cher doesn't actually sound like that if you talk to her. Her voice is being modified by a tool called Auto-Tune, which has really become a sound that's prevalent in hip-hop and all kinds of pop music. But is this tool applicable to, say, newscasters and newsmakers? No, you're not listening to the lost Kennedy tapes there. JFK as an auto-tune object. But what about Katie Couric? People have problems with her anchoring, but does she have a future in music?
Paint chippings and old pesticides may be buried inside. Raising the levels of lead in the soil. The tests are inexpensive and some local health departments do them for free.
Kill out Katie Couric. What you're listening to, though, now in the JFK example and the Katie Couric example is the artistry of Evan and Michael Gregory, both musicians and producers. They're here in the studio using Auto-Tune, this hip-hop voice modifier kind of program which allows voices to be compressed and expanded to fit into rhythmic categories and make them more musical. You've turned them into a whole context-free news source here. I don't know whether to applaud you or to, you know, basically shoot you on sight.
Yeah, maybe we're coming to the wrong place.
It's fascinating what you've done. I actually love listening to JFK doing that. What sorts of other examples have you done, and what sort of fun does this represent? Because some of your videos have actually gone viral and have done pretty well in terms of making their way into the zeitgeist.
The most fun speech example for me was Martin Luther King, because as a reverend, he already had a very lyrical voice. So he was almost already reciting songs and melodies.
So Michael did some work on the I Have a Dream speech and turned it into this anthem. That's gotten a lot of attention online as well. But the video that really went viral for us was the very first one in which we featured Katie Couric, who has this amazing natural voice. And she ended up singing this refrain with our other brother, Andrew. And I think a lot of people were amazed at what you could really do with this software.
Where did you get the idea of doing this? And why did you think Auto-Tune would work for something like this?
I spent some late nights producing some pop records. And over time, I just realized how powerful the software was. People have been using this for over a decade now. But after a while, I was using it to take people's melodies and turning them into harmonies with themselves. And I realized that you could probably do that with speaking voices, too.
So it's sort of taking it beyond a soundbite. I mean, the mission of a soundbite is to get into your brain and to determine the story, even if it's simplistic. This takes it to a whole different level.
That's right. So you have some news clip that maybe the broadcaster wants you to remember. Well, we're using tools from the musical trade where we have catchy melodies. Of course, you can't get those out of your head. When you put those together, you have something really powerful.
So we gave you an example, Evan and Michael Gregory, of our show. And I'm wondering, first of all, before we hear the clip, any sort of assessment of whether the voices on this program lend themselves to auto-tuning?
Yeah, very much so. We were quite impressed. We didn't spend too much time on it. We just wanted to give you the raw take, and
or take away, as the case may be.
Yeah, yes, exactly. we found your voices to be very tunable.
Now, are you sure about that? Because I listened to this and I thought we actually sucked pretty bad. But here, listen, this is the takeaway as envisioned in Auto-Tune by the Gregory brothers.
And in the headlines, Iran's Guardian Council says it's prepared to recount the disputed votes from last week's presidential election. The council is Iran's supreme legislative body.
The youngest son of Kim Jong-il reportedly visited China last week for secret meetings with the Chinese leader. Secret meetings.
Well, I think I should be singing backup to Femi number one. But number two, it seems like we're talking too fast, and it's actually a little bit of a problem for the autotune software.
Well, I think what you find is that you're talking at a normal pace, but once you apply that to a melody, of course, you talk, and you, when you are talking, you speak words much more quickly than you would ever choose to sing them. So for us to fit in your news report into the context of some kind of R&B melody does involve kind of squeezing some things in.
It seems to me this one, using actual members of Congress who tend to blather on endlessly is a real challenge. How have you done with the congressional leaders?
We have to pick and choose with footage. For example, lettuce regulation, spa regulation always works better than.
Yeah, so I think you'll find that we use some conventions from, say, the hip-hop genre, where a lot of times you have very quick delivery of lyrics and rapping, that kind of thing. So we've used some of those audio engineering techniques to squeeze in their speaking.
All right, so that explains why Newt Gingrich, okay, and Representative Jay Inslee, Democrat from Washington, and your character that you've created, Angry Gorilla, are all here in this example.
This bill actually has the Secretary of Energy regulating jacuzzis. Now the idea strikes me as close to being nuts.
I agree, I'm an angry gorilla, and that makes me angry.
The only jacuzzis this will regulate will have to produce 2,500 megawatts of energy.
So you've got Newt Gingrich, your character Angry Gorilla, and they're talking about jacuzzi regulations, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this was part of a larger debate about energy regulation, and Newt Gingrich had found this one part in the bill that he was very angry about. He thought it was much too specific to be dealing with what he found were jacuzzis in the bill. Jay Inslee, of course, is defending. And then Angry Gorilla was our own insertion to kind of highlight the heated emotions taking place.
Well, as you can see, and you guys are studio guys, we only got like that much time left, all right? So the quick question for you is, how does this get beyond play and actually helps to seriously underscore an event? Evan and Michael?
I think we don't have a huge agenda here, but our main idea is that we want to highlight some of the absurdities that take place in the news
cycle.
And
highlight you have, and it's definitely fun to listen to. Evan Gregory, Michael Gregory, thanks so much.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Auto-tune the news.
There's no talking to you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Now the Lord can make you tumble. The Lord can make you turn. The Lord can make you overflow, but the Lord can make you burn, burn on, big river, burn on.
What does it take to make a river burn? Well, they found out in Cleveland, Ohio, about 40 years ago today. The Cuyahoga River blazed for 30 minutes. It was all about pollution. No, the water didn't catch fire. But shortly after that fire, Time magazine ran an article giving it a prominence that catapulted the environmental movement of the late 60s and 70s. Dan Malthrop, host of The Sound of Ideas on our friends at WCPN in Cleveland, joins us now on location on Lake Erie, stone's throw from the mouth of the Cuyahoga, a burning river, Dan. It's history now, but you still remember it, right?
Well, I wasn't here, but yes, the whole city still remembers it. John, how are you? Good morning. It's 40 years. You know, that last time in 1969 when the river burned 40 years ago today, that was the last time of many, many burns, and a really, like, relatively minor burn, minor fire on the river at that point. There had been many worse fires on the river. That one only caused about $50,000 in damage.
And, you know, in the case of the Cuyahoga River, I mean, it's actually easy to start a fire on a river. You just spread a lot of gasoline and light it. But the Cuyahoga was so deeply polluted, and Lake Erie became so deeply polluted, it really became an emblem for the environmental movement.
Yeah, it did. And that was partly due to the fact that the Time magazine story that covered it also was the same issue as the coverage of Ted Kennedy's Chappaquiddick incident. So it was a very widely read issue.
Wow. Wow.
Just kind of bad timing for the river. But it's sort of bad timing, but good timing, because it created, it sort of lent a lot of muscle to the environmental movement. And it was one of many events that sparked, so to speak, the Clean Water Act and the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency.
Well, speaking of sparks, any luck trying to set the river or the lake on fire this morning?
No. I've been trying. I've been throwing matches in all morning. Nothing.
So, but it's a serious point. I mean, the fish are safer now. You can actually go swimming.
It's not even that the fish are safer. I mean, I'm actually going on vacation after this morning on the shores of Lake Erie, and I'll be swimming every day if I can. But the, I mean, in 1969 and in the decade after, they would be checking for wildlife, and there was nothing. They would find one or two fish. You know, they'd run 10 miles up the Cuyahoga and find one or two fish. There are between 40 and 60 species of fish living in the Cuyahoga now.
Which is why Cuyahoga Valley National Park and other organizations are celebrating 2009 as the Year of the River.
Exactly. And it's a big deal. Now, it's interesting, the Environmental Protection Agency, the folks who've been doing the cleanup, the Cuyahoga River Community Planning Organization and the Remedial Action Plan people, they have been trying to get portions of the river delisted, because the Cuyahoga is still one of the EPA's areas of concern in terms of the Lake Erie water or the Great Lakes watershed.
But it's still a great story. 40 years ago, it caught on fire, and now you're thinking of going on vacation. Dan Malthrop, host of The Sound of Ideas, broadcasting live from Lake Erie, WCPN in Cleveland. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, John.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Don't go anywhere, folks. The New York Times executive editor Bill Keller is going to join us in just a moment to tell the story of reporter David Rode escaping from the Taliban in Pakistan and why the Times kept all other media agencies from reporting that detention for as much as 7 months. Femi Okeh is here with the headlines.
And the time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. This afternoon, President Obama signs groundbreaking new tobacco legislation into law. The Food and Drug Administration will now have power over tobacco products. The FDA will be able to reduce nicotine content, ban candy flavoring, and block labels like light or low tar. America's new top commander in Afghanistan is clamping down on American bombing runs. Now, a partner of the New York Times reports that General Stanley McChrystal will sharply restrict the use of airstrikes. It's part of an effort to reduce civilian deaths. More than a dozen are dead in Iraq after a series of attacks there. Violence has spiked lately. The end of this month is the deadline for American forces to leave major cities in Iraq. In sports news, Wimbledon has started today. The two-week tennis tournament has a new feature this year. A retractable roof over the main court means that play can go on even when rain shows up. And the US Venus Williams and Roger Federer of Switzerland are among the favourites to win. Right now, Federer is playing Yan Xun Lu of China, and he's up 2-0. And finally, this is the sound of the US soccer team earning respect in a major international tournament.
You heard the kick, you heard the goal, one of three goals. So often mocked for being less than stellar, the US team shocked the soccer world by getting into the finals of the Confederations Cup. This is the international tournament seen as a dress rehearsal before the big Soccer World Cup that happens next year. The US beat Egypt 3-0 and go on to play Spain on Wednesday. Good luck to them. That's Look at Your News for now.
Thank you, Femi. So on Friday in Pakistan, there was an extraordinary escape by a hostage being held by Taliban captors. The hostage was a reporter from our partner, the New York Times, David Rode, Pulitzer Prize winner, had been in the hands of the Taliban since last November when he was captured outside Kabul while working on a book about the region. On Friday, he climbed over a wall on the second floor of a compound in North Waziristan. He was joined by an Afghan journalist who was also held captive along with their driver. The driver did not escape. Now, you may not have known that David Rode was held hostage at all. That's because the New York Times has kept this entire story secret in an effort to protect Mr. Rode and to facilitate his escape. Bill Keller is the executive editor of the New York Times, who followed this for the last 7 months. He joins us now. Bill, congratulations. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Good morning, John.
I mean, I guess it's fair to say that there is no more difficult and larger responsibility for any executive editor, besides the veracity of the news, than the safety of your reporters all around the world.
Yeah, and of course, this is one of those excruciating cases where the two responsibilities came into conflict. I mean, obviously, our instinct, our default position is that we report stuff, and sitting on a story feels unnatural and it makes us cringe. On the other hand, I have to make decisions about what's in the best welfare of these people who go out and take sometimes great risks to bring back the news. And in this case, it was, I think, a pretty clear consensus that keeping the story quiet and imploring all our colleagues and other news organizations to keep it quiet was the right thing to do, just in terms of keeping the danger to David as low as we possibly could.
Now, Bill Keller, for all kinds of reasons, we're restricted in the sort of factual information that we're going to get into here, and we can talk mm-hmm. about why that is in a moment. But it's a hard question, but I have to ask it. How much of the Daniel Pearl story, Wall Street Journal journalist who, of course, was killed in Pakistan years ago at the beginning of the whole 9/11 period, how much of that story was a cautionary tale for you, thinking about the welfare of David Rode?
That Danny Pearl has a number of very close friends here in the Times newsroom, so that story was one that hovered over the whole experience, and there are a number of others. We spent a lot of time talking to executives at various companies, including the Wall Street Journal, but not only, who've had reporters or other employees taken hostage in the Middle East region, and we sought their advice. There's sadly a rather large club of people who have this sort of experience, and it's something of a support group, we discovered. Hmm.
So do you think that your strategy to keep the lid on this story bought David Rode time? Because his escape at least looks to me as though it was serendipity, that he found an opportunity and he managed to get out on his own.
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you at this point whether anything we did made any difference. It does feel like serendipity. But I will tell you, I talked to David this morning about a lot of things. But in the course of it, he said one point he wanted to make was that the decision to keep this quiet was absolutely right. He said his captors were completely obsessed with his value as a commodity, and a lot of news coverage would have made them more determined than ever just to hang on to him.
Wow, that's a huge piece of information. You were also in Iran this last week and reporting on the story, of course, which is in the same region. It involves some of the same issues, Islamists versus people who want to run governments in a very different way. First of all, how much of a distraction was the Rode story as you tried to cover Iran? And secondly, did you worry about the fate of David Rode as the situation in Iran began to unfold?
We've been living with the David Rode situation for, 200 and some days. So I learned that he was set free when my plane landed back in New York after I'd left Iran. So his case was, while it's always been a kind of nagging presence in the back of my mind wasn't a live issue most of the time that I was in Iran. I mean, one thing they do have in common, though, is that Iran itself is becoming a somewhat more treacherous place to work, particularly since the election and the crackdown by the government. And so once again, we're thinking very hard about, you know, what steps we might have to take to protect our people.
You know, Bill Keller, I have this conversation with a lot of your reporters. I don't want to drag them out into an area where they have to speculate because they're not comfortable doing that. They always yell at me when I suggest that they do it. But it seems to me, with the situation in Iran and this escape of David Rode, that it is perhaps fair to say that something's shifting in the Islamic world. There's something going on there that it seems very, very different from even 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I would connect what, you know. I mean, David's does seem like a combination of planning, desperation, and good luck. And I'm not sure what, you know, sort of larger geopolitical conclusions can be drawn from that. There may be some. I don't know. Iran, on the other hand, is something quite profound is happening there. I mean, there are essentially two pillars of the Iranian regime. One of them is clerical, religious, Islamic, and it's supposedly made up of this very sort of unanimous consensus view of what the Quran tells you about how to run your society. And the other is democratic, secondary pillar, which has an elected president, an elected parliament. And that one is supposed to provide a kind of legitimacy and a safety valve.
But I think you can. Exactly. But I think you can also say that with the pictures coming out of Iran, these pictures of Iranian victims in the streets, suddenly the pictures of Western reporters and Westerners being held hostage and victims of Islamist forces don't have the cachet that they used to. These pictures from the streets of Tehran are more powerful.
Well, they're certainly plenty powerful. I mean, this is, you know, I've been clicking onto YouTube regularly just to watch the video since I left. They have a profound importance inside Iran in terms of keeping the fire alive and mobilizing people, and a tremendously important role outside in keeping the rest of us aware of what's going on there.
Well, Bill, I'll put a moratorium on the speculation at this point. One thing you don't have to speculate on in a time of difficult headlines for the newspaper business and your paper particularly, tell me something about the mood at the New York Times this morning.
I think the mood is pretty ecstatic and relieved because of David's freedom, and he has a lot of friends here, and it's nice to have a good story to tell, and I expect once he's had a little family time, he will tell it.
Well, Bill Keller, executive editor for our partner, the New York Times, it's safe for me to say, have a good day.
Thank you very much.
I think you will. Bill Keller, of course, talking about the situation with David Rode, who escaped last Friday from 7 months of captivity by the Taliban. We're also keeping up with the latest from Iran. When you look at the news on TV or in photos, your takeaway can come from all kinds of sources. Listen to this.
In every city that you see people are demonstrating, they've got these English placards because they want not only to show to themselves that they are different class, but also they want the world to know about them and what is happening to them.
Bakr Moeen, former head of the BBC's Persian Language Service, looking at the images as the rest of us are out of Iran. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. Or my take at thetakeaway.org. See ya.